Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday. It is the 26th of October, and it is a delight to have you with us. Thank you so much for being here. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. It is our roundtable panel discussion where we sit around a table, discuss the issues of the day, try to make sense of the world at hand, and usually fail miserably at it. But we try. We do try.
Speak for yourself.
What? Do we try?
I'm just kidding.
Okay.
And all we want to talk about today is baseball, right?
No, well, that was a great game.
Baseball. What a game.
What a great game. Great game.
How many 8 home runs?
Oh, all right. Oh, so I have to admit, though, I fell asleep. I couldn't stay. I tried to stay awake. I couldn't stay awake. I woke up like at 3 o'clock in the morning with the TV on, and oh, well. Let me introduce the panel to you. Teresa Bourgeois is here, communications consultant. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
I'm just doing great. I love the game. I don't even care about either team, but I love the game.
We have such a cool panel today. Journalist and editor and our dear friend, he is back. We are so excited. Stu Shinsky is in town. Hello, sir.
Hi, guys. How you been?
Well, I've been great.
You've been wonderful. I'm a great, great, faithful listener. You guys are amazing.
We are so excited that you are back.
I'm honored to be here.
Lovely to have you here and to have you back. We've missed you horribly, and it's wonderful to have you here. WAMC's Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, sir. Hi, Joe.
You're excited about the game too, Alan?
Yeah, also very, very excited.
He's like, "What game?"
And then we're
I was asleep for an hour when the you know, I got to sleep at 7, so by the time the thing goes on at 8 o'clock, I'm not there. I mean, I'm somewhere else, and then I wake up in the middle of the night like everybody else does, and it says, you know, the Astros won. It's 1-1 now. I say, okay, who cares?
Oh, stop.
It was historic.
You're rooting for Brooklyn, aren't you?
I am.
Yes.
Yes.
You know, every once in a while, a lot of times we get these pitches of people who are coming in the region, and we people will say, oh, would you like to speak to? And we always throw this out of, yeah, do you think they'd like to be a part of the panel? And usually they say no. Well, which by the way, it has nothing to do. They always want to take part in the panel, but it's usually a timing thing.
Oh,
well, we're very, very lucky that the award-winning writer, he's an acclaimed poet, novelist, and essayist, Luis Alberto Urrea, is going to be speaking tonight at Union College at Knott Memorial in the Knott Memorial at 7 o'clock. Universal border from Tijuana to the world. He is a best-selling author of 16 books, including The Devil's Highway, A True Story. And he is one of the most compelling and beautiful writers that we have today. And it is a great pleasure to have you add to our conversation.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you very much. We have a lot to talk about. We'll get into your background. But what brings you ultimately to... to Union? Is there a reason other than they paid you? Or
I wanted to have dinner at Zen over by the hotel. So, I kind of live on the road, and it's amazing to me how many people want to talk, particularly in these times. I think people really want to talk about immigration issues and border issues and walls and things. So I just go everywhere I can. I'm partially here perhaps on missionary work because I have a grad student who's desperate to teach here. So I said, I'll go talk about you to them. but
that's excellent. So when you come in as, let's just go back a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Did you, when you were hearing what was being said by the man who would become the president of the United States, did you think, well, this isn't going to happen? Or were you frightened of it at that moment?
It was a more virulent and honest expression of things that I've grown up hearing my whole life, and energies that are very evident to people who find themselves in the shadows. So I'd had a wonderful experience, and I'm still having it. The NEA picked one of my books as, you know, part of the big read program, partially I think because I wasn't dead. You know, all the other authors are Poe and, you know, Mark
right.
Twain and Ray Bradbury. I think they thought, wow, let's send the kids somebody who's still breathing. And so I'd been dealing with an ever-growing population of these students, now known, I think, as dreamers, but and they were terrified already. And so when this happened, I thought there's just no possible way that he can win. It can't. It's not possible. And so I think I discounted it on a certain level, and then in some ways the unthinkable happened for so many of us. And it was ironic in some ways because right before election night, I was in Kauai having a great time and watching the World Series on Hawaiian TV, and the Cubs won, and I thought, all is right with the world. We finally broke the curse, and we're going to come back, and Hillary's going to win, and my wife is super happy, and everybody's happy. And then this strange collapse of all morale happened in Chicago when it turned out differently. And I think I saw kind of cataclysmic terror and isolation hitting that population that I end up speaking to.
So I wanted to ask something, if I may, very quickly. So is no matter how I ask this question, it's going to come out wrong.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry. Has it turned out to be absolutely as bad as you thought it would? When you see a guy's election, you see what he's talking about with the wall, and you see all of that stuff. Seems to me it's bad, all right. It's terrible. But it doesn't seem to be the ultimate bad.
Not yet.
No, not yet.
That's it, right? You don't know what's coming around the bend.
No, you don't. And I honestly think a lot of it is just bluster and upending the apple cart. You know, it feels a little bit nihilistic. But, you know, for example, there are these sections of this fabled wall going up in San Diego.
Right. Yeah.
And the most amusing on some level, but I thought really smart piece of journalism I saw was, you know, reporters sent up a drone to film them from above. And he said, note to the president, the fact that we have a drone high above your wall to film it should tell you the wall is useless.
Right.
Because there's been a guy who's been sending drugs over with drones, you know, 30 kilos a week. So it's a weird phenomenon to watch. And I think it sort of unleashes backyard too much beer banter as the discourse of the nation. And if it is my job in some sense to minister to kids who, it wasn't my intention certainly, but now that's what happens, to minister to kids who are here and in the shadows, I realize also that I'm in some ways ministering to their teachers, because every town in America, and I understand the response people have, every town is a border town.
Right.
You know, and you go to Arkansas and they say, what do we do? And you go to Mississippi and they say, what do we do? And so I'm trying to sort of use my blessing to be able to speak both languages, know both cultures, write books to try to make these bridges of communication.
I just want to give people a quick sketch, biographical sketch of you. But you were born in Tijuana.
Yeah.
Your father was Mexican. Mm-hmm. Your mother was American.
New Yorker all the way.
And then you wind up in Naperville, Illinois, which is brings out the Cub in you, right? That's the that makes you the Cubs fan of Naperville.
I'm in my heart. I bleed Dodger blue, you know that, right?
Yeah, I'm sure.
They're the Mexican team, Los Dodgers. You grew up loving Los Dodgers.
And so now, distinguished professor of creative writing at the University of Illinois, Chicago,
yeah.
And a member of the Latino Literature Hall of Fame. So it's a great pleasure and an honor to have you
Thank
with
you.
Us this morning. So we'll start knocking through our topics and get your take on some of these along with the rest of our panel members. We welcome your letters. All you have to do is write to us. It's panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. All right, let us get started then and talk about what's happening in the world. And we begin with our friend, well, I shouldn't say that, should I? let's talk about tax cuts. We'll talk about what's going on. And the headline in the New York Times this morning, tax cuts are the glue holding a fractured Republican Party together. One week before they are set to unveil a sprawling overhaul of the federal tax code, Republicans struggled on Wednesday with key parts of their plan, reigniting a fight over retirement savings and racing to cut a deal with lawmakers from high-tax states ahead of a critical budget vote in the House on Thursday. The challenges and the dogged effort to resolve them on Capitol Hill highlight the increased importance of the tax issue for a fractured party desperate for a legislative victory. The prospect of once-in-a-generation bill to cut taxes on businesses and individuals increasingly appears to be the best hope for a party anxious to find common ground and advance an effort that it has long championed as the pinnacle of Republican orthodoxy. It is a bit like having a baby to save a failing marriage. But, like a crying newborn, the drafting of the bill is already costing party leaders lots of sleep. All right. So with that said, read from the New York Times. Where do you think we are in this, Alan?
Well, what's fascinating is you're now seeing the Republican Party coming apart. You have major U.S. senators, at least three, four of them, who are saying this is a very bad president, very bad morality, and a bad guy. But they're basically conservative people. So that they are going to be with the president theoretically on the need for the tax cut. That's how they ran. That's how they got elected. It has not a lot to do with the fact that they just hate the guy's guts. And so that's a problem for the Republicans. Now, I think one of the things that they do is they put some things in this bill. Or what we think is the bill, because once again, it's secret. But they put stuff in the bill, which they can then use as classic. You read The Art of the Deal by Trump, that they can use as classic trading fodder. They can take out, for example, the deductibility of state and local taxes. That's going to be incredibly important. We get guys like John Faso and Collins, Republicans in New York, who are saying, I can't go along with this. So,
are they going to vote for it today?
Here you go.
Yeah, are they going to?
But will they vote for it today, even though they say they can't go along with it?
Faso was undecided, last I heard.
What he said is, I can't support this. That doesn't mean he's not going to vote for you. You're quite right, Stuart.
And the other thing with this is obviously the 401k. I mean, if they're going to start screwing around with the deductions.
Yeah.
I mean, the theory, as I understand, is that they're going to limit what you can put into your 401k, which means more of your current income is taxable, is tax revenue. That's how they get their money to cover whatever they want to cover. But to me, it's like the new third rail. Like Social Security is always the third rail. You don't touch it. I don't think they're going to go anywhere near 401ks and think they're going to survive at the elections.
Well,
I mean, that is our future, right? The 401. I mean, for those of us who are lucky enough to even have one, that's the future. And if you start screwing around with that, then what do you do?
Yeah.
That's because we have very few defined pensions anymore. Everybody is into 401s. And therefore, this is first there was this sort of bait and switch. Everybody had to do it. We all went over to these. But on the other hand, and there are very few pensions that are left, except if you work for the government. It is something that is, I don't think it's Social Security, by the way, and I don't think it's Medicare, and I don't think an awful lot of people understand it all.
But I thought that was just in there as a deflection, like the NFL fight. I thought it was to get people to focus on that so they don't focus on the underlying details like the cuts to, you throw it up there, you argue about it, Trump comes in and says, well, I'm not going to do that because he says I want to be on the side of the working people when the outline shows that the bill overall is skewed dramatically toward the top 1%. But if everyone just focuses on this debate and they hear Trump say, well, I'm going to put a stop to that, then that puts him on the right side of an issue that was never going anywhere anyway.
Exactly.
It's just a deflection.
Right.
Yeah. That's just a toy. It's a dangerous toy, but it's just a toy. I thought it was interesting, Congressman Peter King yesterday in the House side, because of the state deductibility issue, he says they're asking us to vote on a budget for a tax bill they haven't shown us, on a promise that somehow it's going to be fair, even though they're talking about knocking out the deductible.
It's an interesting because, you know, Teresa, Cuomo named five congressmen, Republican congressmen he was going after, but he didn't name Peter King.
Right.
But
today, you know, this may well pass the House. That's why I'm saying, are these folks, is Stefanik locally, is she going to vote for it? Will Congressman Faso vote for it? You know, around who among the Republican delegation in our area, you know, in Connecticut or Massachusetts, whether will they vote for this? Do they even know what's in it?
It's well, we know they don't.
Right, they
King
don't know what's in it.
And
we know that there are these, we want to see details because you know they've got the details. And they said, we're going to wait till after this overall structure passes and then we'll put out the details.
But this is, and Alan, I'm going to go to you on this because and we only have about a minute before the break, but I don't get it. If they have been, the Republicans have been impacted, let's say that, impacted by this strategy several times over the last several months, where they've tried to do everything in secret, and then it all explodes at the end. So at what point do you realize maybe that's not the best strategy?
I don't know, but they're not doing it.
New York's been doing that for years. I don't see the difference. I mean, do it all in secret.
No, that still makes a point. They do it in the middle of the night in New York. You don't get the bill until the ink is fresh. Yeah. You know, on it, they don't print it or whatever.
We
know, though, that it does have cuts in Medicaid and cuts in Medicare. Right. We know it has a $1 trillion blows a hole in the deficit, at least by $3 trillion. And so that's not conservative.
But it's the Medicare, by the way, that's going to really bite them in the you-know-what.
They haven't figured out how to pay for it.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We have a wonderful panel here, and we welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. And we will continue our conversation after this news break from the BBC. Great music from Fats Domino, who we lost yesterday at the age of 89. New Orleans rhythm and blues singer who was simply the best. And
good life.
Wonderful stuff. So we will be playing all of our bumper music today from the great Fats Domino.
Yay.
And we'll be,
we're losing so many people.
We are.
Oh,
my
God. So many great musicians are just dying.
People keep dying.
Every day.
Every day.
Yeah, what's up with that? Can't we do something about
a special round table?
93 from gun violence, 140 from the opioid epidemic. And
well, you just brought that down.
And wonderful musicians who we hear their music today.
Gosh, I'm feeling so cheerful now.
Sorry. I am so bored.
Yeah, right?
Alan Chartok is here. Stu Shinsky is back. Teresa Bourgeois is here. And we also have acclaimed poet, novelist, and essayist Luis Alberto Urrea, who is speaking tonight at Union College at Knott Memorial at 7 o'clock. The talk, Universal Border from Tijuana to the World. It's free. It's open to the public. And we'll just give you a taste today of the wonderful insights of this great writer and great man. And we thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
It's an honor to have you with us. All right. So let's talk about other stuff before we go to letters. And I think this is a subject that is... one that we've sort of known was coming, but we're going to see officially now, and that is the fact that President Trump today is expected to direct the government to declare the opioid crisis a nationwide public health emergency. Mm. He will speak on this matter this afternoon. He obviously, I think we all know this, made this an issue of his campaign, and is going to be now talking about it. The declaration does not come with specific funding, but officials say it will allow changes such as expanded access to medical services in rural areas. And one more fact here that I want to. The speech will come Thursday. He said an emergency designation will give his administration the power to do things that you can't do right now. I don't know what that means.
I don't know either. I was ask you, what does that mean?
No, it's one thing when you say it's an emergency. It's another thing when you designate it.
Yeah, when you try to fix it.
Emergency, because what happened is, right.
Oh, Stu.
I mean, I'm against red lights, but, you know, I mean, what do you do about this?
Well, you know? Right. No, I think you're right on the money, Stu, because the real question here is, what is the crisis of morality? What is it of ethical responsibility? What is it that makes somebody, I mean, I so couldn't imagine putting anything into my blood and doing an injection, and yet at historic rates this is happening in this country and people are dying all over. So not only is the question what can the federal government do to give a couple of more dollars to, you know, to hospitals and others to do this, or to again do Narcan, which is very important, that, you know, you can save a life with this, but what is it that's making people do this?
Go ahead, Teresa.
Well, I think that former Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin really brought attention to this in 2014, the rate at which people were dying. Mm-hmm, I think this was happening in the shadows before that. But now that people have shined a light on it, and I will say Hillary Clinton did also shine a bright light on this, and then people like Trump and others came along. Governor Shaheen and former governor, now senator, in New Hampshire also in these rural areas.
But can you answer the question?
What they tracked it back to, in many cases, the epidemic is because of the increased focus on giving people pain meds over the last decade, particularly OxyContin. And OxyContin is like the pill form of heroin. And so people get OxyContin because of a, you know, broken arm, broken leg, whatever, and then they become addicted to it. Their prescription runs out, and then they're in trouble, and then they then start trying to get heroin and other things.
We've all heard that. Frankly, I just got off a back operation. They gave me OxyContin.
And did you use it or not?
Yes. I used it day one, three times. It's the lowest form of this. I used it the second day two times. I used it the third day one time, and that was it, because I would not even consider the potential that this I could start to rely on this stuff. But what I'm wondering, again, is, and I don't believe, by the way, that we have this heroin epidemic only because of the opioids. There's something going on in this country where people think this is a way to avoid pain, psychological pain, or other pain. That's what it's about.
Heroin use economic is cyclical factors. But I think there's an added focus. But what's interesting to me about this announcement today, there was an interesting piece in Politico yesterday where the head of the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, the head of the DEA, the head of the person at Center for Disease Control who handles these issues, none of them were consulted or engaged in this response. It's going to be announced today.
Well, I wonder, what do you got?
What do I got?
Bring it.
Interested in your thoughts, especially when you were talking about the drones earlier. I mean, it's interesting because this is going to be part of it, isn't it? Don't you think, as the president makes this a centerpiece of whatever, it will come into the wall and a lot of other issues that he's been hammering away at.
I've learned this last year to try to peek behind the curtain to see what the big statement is hiding, because I think as we go crazy over some big statement of something and start scuttling around, then all kinds of things happen that we don't notice. But, you know, my own family has been really consumed in many generations with this phenomenon. And I watch it, of course, the way the border is functioning and watching how the drug trade functions. My family comes from the state of Sinaloa, which is, you know, Chapo Guzman's territory. And they have this really weird and terrifying pragmatic attitude toward it. One of my cousins said to me, it's not hard living amongst them, just stay away from the massacres. Wow. And I thought, wow, there's some practical advice I don't want to hear. But, you know, their take is continually in Mexico, if you would stop consuming, we would go back to making arts and crafts, but it's a multi-billion dollar operation for them. I think we have a very long, the beginning history of medicating. And, you know, perhaps
and self-medication.
Self-medication, yeah, improvised. A little scotch, a little bourbon,
right?
A little vodka,
ibuprofen,
ibuprofen. But you know, I think that the pain is dictating.
Yes.
The tidal wave and the malaise. I mean, we get to sit here together in this beautiful little studio and have our coffee and talk it out. And I think a lot of people don't have the wherewithal to talk it out.
Sure.
And I don't think they have any scope of hope or progress to get out of that malaise they find themselves in. There's a lot of good writing about it. I also notice in Mexico the rapaciousness of the people who profit off of this. Within the last, I'd say, 15 years, the narcos did something unheard of there when they realized that they could more easily, you know, cook ice and sell meth cheaper, transport it more easily. But they then made a lateral corporate move, and rather than export it, they went domestic and they spread meth amongst their own citizens.
Hmm.
So there's an epidemic there of meth usage because they made money off it.
At the risk of going off on a soapbox here, I was struck by when you said pain.
Me too.
Because there's a physical pain that starts many, and we were just talking about that, of breaking an arm, breaking a hip, whatever the case may be. But most people are medicating an internal,
exactly,
psychological pain,
yeah,
that they have.
Breaking a soul.
And that seems to be, and I'm quite sure that our history of this proves that we will not address that, which is the mental degradation that so many of us have, that are dealing with just the complexities of life, which in much of society, even though they are also part of it, much of society just looks at the person and says, well, you know, dust yourself off and keep walking and get over it. Well, easier said than done.
But it's also generational, isn't it? In other words, we know that, I know somebody, you know, other people who have, you know, self-medicated and done all of this stuff. But a major political figure in New York City, a lobbyist, just got picked up with meth in his house.
There's
this guy who argues for reform of government, but for the most part, it is our younger people who are getting into this stuff, and millennials and minors. That seems to me to signal, as you have said, a lack of hope, a lack of where we, you know, what, how can I make out in the society? I can't.
Can I ask a question? What do y'all think about the difference between how the opioid crisis is being handled versus how the crack and meth, that was all lock them up and this is all help them out? I mean, why do you think the difference?
Well, I think there's been a lot of enforcement actions against this, but I think there's a tie here to the economy, where the economy was on its butt for several years.
Yes.
And, you know, the wonderful point you made about the internal pain and the malaise and the looking for the answers. And I mean, look at a state like Ohio. Trump country.
New Hampshire, Maine.
Yeah.
West Virginia.
Yes.
You know, the jobs, the economic fortunes have been, in many cases, just pathetic and awful, and the opportunities have not been there. So I think that self-medication thing, it's not just they have some situations going. It's just, you know, a feeling of loss and nowhere to turn.
It is.
And certainly the drug companies, as 60 Minutes in the Washington Post showed a few weeks ago, there's a lot of money out there to be made off of people's addiction.
Yeah, I agree. And ironically enough, it's in some weird way a survival technique. It's going to get me through the night. It will destroy my life, but it's going to get me through the night. And that to watch it, I watch it up close. But I also want to say that, you know, being in this weird position I mentioned earlier with the NEA and talking to schools and things, I'm meeting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of young people. And my youngest daughter is 17, and I'm with her generation a lot. And I teach, and I realize that all they hear over and over is the world may be beyond saving. You know, the Bill McKibben crowd saying it's already past the tipping point. It's going to end in your generation. And so there's this hopelessness. They had their hopes set on Bernie, you know, or they had their hopes set elsewhere. And I think there's a lot of the young folks just see this wall, no pun intended, ahead of them.
And then there's another thing. There is the Trump hyphen Duarte model.
Oh, God.
Now,
yeah.
Here is Trump, who is making a hero out of a guy who rounds him up and shoots him.
Yep.
Dead people, 2,000 dead people, you know, in this drug war. So you have a guy who's going to declare an emergency, but at the same time, right, in addition to his emergency, what is the way, what's the model to deal with it? Is it what, because he so admires Duarte.
I know. Don't look for a lot of counseling, I don't think. I have, my paranoia is, please, no form of martial law.
Right.
And it seems like it would be very easy to target. You know, let's find the lowest power voice in our culture, and we can target those guys as bad guys, which we, I think, have done with immigrants over and over again. And that worries me.
You are so right about the martial law. I've said that from the very beginning.
Yeah,
I've always
scary.
Thought that's exactly where he's going.
All those generals in the White House, I think, whoa, this is complicated.
And it turns out that they're the better ones.
Yes.
In that crowd.
Yeah.
But also the dissonance of today is this announcement. It's also likely the House is going to pass this budget framework, and it calls for cuts in Medicaid and Medicare, and they haven't dealt with, you know, they're pulling apart the Affordable Care Act. So this is all getting at reducing access to health care and access to treatment. And, you know, they still have not renewed the community health centers funding that was expired October 1st, so on and so forth. So in all aspects of the healthcare system, they're tearing it apart. So how are they really going to have a viable response to this when one of the biggest gaps is when people seek help, there's no place for them to go?
Yes, and even if you gave them the money, would we have the trained professionals, the number of trained professionals who could come up with a solution? Because the solution is not only psychological, which it is certainly, but it's also political. I mean, we have to have the will to say, okay, something is happening in this country, which is really depressing, and people don't have hope. How are we going to restore that hope?
It is interesting that this opioid announcement is going to be today.
Yes. Yes.
Very interesting. Coincidence? Oh, I don't think so.
No.
I don't think so.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we have some letters. I want to read those, and then we have a letter. Is that? I think there'll be more. But by the time we come back, there'll
be
more.
Letter.
We have a
help.
Letter.
I see
letter.
Them here. There's more. Okay. So we'll go with that. We'll continue our conversation, and we welcome your letters. Hey, add to the pile.
Hey.
Panel. At, hey.
Make a pile.
Panel at WAMC.org.
Panel.
No, that's not till
10. I think that's what they're doing.
That's not till 10 o'clock. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion today. Alan Chartok, Stu Shinsky, award-winning poet, novelist, and essayist Luis Alberto Urrea, and Teresa Bourgeois, all with us this morning. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. The pile has arrived to Alan's desk, and he is ready to read them now.
Yes, sir. Or try to, anyway.
All right, Alan.
All right. So Joseph said, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey,
good morning.
Hi, Joseph.
It will good man, Luis.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
It will perhaps come to light that the addiction to opioids is enhanced, prodded, and abided by the addiction to tobacco. Cigarettes gave a lot of additional chemical aid to make the brain more easily addicted to tobacco and therefore also to other very addictive drugs. Anybody? You know, I don't think there's any doubt that cigarettes are bad, very bad, and
bad.
That they can kill you. And I'm sure that there is some truth to that, but it sure doesn't account for everything that's going on with addiction in this
country.
I
think the pharmaceutical industry, advertising, doctors over-medicating, focus on pain, and some well-intentioned focus on pain that they
absolutely, they are. You get an operation, and your doctor's going to tell you, don't suffer with the pain, take the pill.
But they're changing that now.
Well, they are and they aren't. In other words, if you have a major operation and you're really hurting, they're going to tell you to take the pill because there's no reason to hurt. And I think they have to judge who they're giving the medication to.
Absolutely.
Also.
And a lot of addicts went doctor shopping when their doctors would say, no more pills.
Yes.
They'd go to other doctors. And then New York created this program called iStop, where it's basically a large database of doctors giving out pills.
Yeah.
And when they couldn't get that, the addicts went to heroin. That's why in Dutchess County there's been a huge heroin upswing.
I have to say that at one point when I had a previous operation, I had a lot of this stuff left over, and I brought it to the police station.
Oh.
And I went over to the guy at the desk, and I said, can I have a receipt? And he said, we don't give receipts. I want you all to think about that. So, because, you know, that leaves for a lot of unaccounted stuff out there. Do you see where I'm going here?
Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
So Paul says, good morning, panel.
Good morning. Mm-hmm.
Interesting
good
discussion morning. As always. I understand there is also the problem of deaths from despair today. People, especially middle age, whose lives are in tough shape, they turn to all manners of self-medication, opioids and heroin are among them. This is partly why that group had the only drop in life expectancy recently. Interesting. Yeah, there are certainly people who are despondent. Sean says, hi, all. I agree that opioids actually cause the brain to create additional receptors that must be attached to by the drug to get the same effect. If a prescription is given, especially before all the info was released, and you take a fair amount, those receptors are created. And when you stop, those receptors cry out and there is pain. That is not true for other drugs or alcohol. Extra receptors are not created. That's from Sean.
Wow.
Interesting.
Yeah, that made me think. One of the things I've noticed in my kids' world, that some of the kids are now dealing electronic drugs. I don't know what that is, but it scares me to death that there are apparently programs one can buy from some program pusher, and you put it on your iPhone and you can get stoned off these tonalities.
Ooh, wow.
I don't know what they are.
Wow.
That's it. I think we are doomed now because we're already addicted to this stupid little device.
Yeah.
All true. Okay. Jonathan said,
Jonathan said
the comment by Alan is terrifying in its ignorance. What is making people do this? Another panel member correctly informed us that people are becoming addicted through prescription opiates, which then cause the unfortunate person to seek drugs. Alan needs to read up on this. Not all people will become addicted to prescription drugs. Many will. I didn't. Hey, come on now. One doesn't know who will and who won't. The real villains here are the Sackler family and Big Pharma, who deal these drugs for so many years, knowing exactly what they are doing. The vast majority of those addicted to heroin started with prescription drugs. Is there anybody who heard me deny that? That this was okay. And he signs it Lloyd RPH, means something PH, pharmacy. Yeah.
Oh.
Okay. Our very good friend Tony says more attention is being paid to this drug crisis because there are so many white people involved. Crack was inner city and mostly black people.
Right. Treated completely differently. It was a lock 'em up.
Yeah.
It was a lock 'em up effort. I know because I worked in Boston and, you know, doing that, and it was all about lock them up, and this is all about help them out. I think help them out is a better approach.
Okay, and Scott says, you ask why, panel? In our overstimulated, consumption-based culture of instant gratification, many people who feel left out are looking for at least a brief shot at something that could pass for joy. We are not taught to look in the right places for true happiness, and that's from Scott. And Alan says, Teresa asked why we locked up crackheads in the 80s but need to help opioid users. The answer is that white folks are the ones dying from opioids. The end. Thanks. And that's Alan. But I think it's a little bit restricted because there are black people dying from these drugs and from heroin, obviously. So
Okay. I do think that there's always been a six. I'm not an expert in this, but there's been a cycle of heroin and speed, heroin, speed, speed them up, slow them down, speed them up. I think that if you look at the literature, you see that there is a cycle of this. But I think what you talked about earlier, what's driving, you know, it's really demand driven. The issues in Mexico are demand driven by the U.S., just like the, you know, problems in other places with poppy and other things. If we can cut down the demand in the U.S., it would solve a lot of problems elsewhere and save us a lot of money.
Christian from Hillsdale said, hello, panel.
Hello, Christian.
Today's Washington Post has a column that compares the outgoing GOP ideals of Jeff Flake and the incoming GOP ideals of Judge Roy Moore. It is a very gloomy and disheartening read, to say the least. I feel it can be argued, for as repugnant a man as Trump is, he's merely the volatile fuel for this hateful, ignorant fire that smoldered long before he arrived. Trump simply provided an outlet for all this hatred and frustration to be released. He, along with his supporters, smashed open the Pandora's box of bigotry, misogyny, and xenophobia and unleashed it upon all of us. Have, and this is capitalized, they, no sense of decency. Enough, says Christian.
We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will return to our panel discussion after this news break.
It's Fats Domino. From somebody who said, why don't you play any Fats this morning? That's all we've been playing.
That's all we've been playing. That's right. Fats Domino.
Welcome to Blueberry Hill.
Yeah. Passed away at the age of 89. We were just talking about New Orleans during the break, but a New Orleans guy. And so very nice to hear that music and think of his great legacy this morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. Let me just reintroduce the panel to you. Dr. Alan Chartok is here. Stu Shinsky is back. We are thrilled that Stu is here.
An honor, sir. Thank you.
That's great. It's been a while since he's been back. You're in regular rotation now, right?
We'll see.
Excellent.
We'll
get you in there. get your agent working on that contract, my friend. Luis Alberto Urrea is with us. He is a writer. He is going to be speaking tonight at Union College at 7 o'clock at Knott Memorial, and we are thrilled that he's spending the morning with us.
Having a great time.
Very much.
And he's incredibly smart.
Yes,
he is.
What great insights. It's so
Cubs
wonderful
fan
to
too.
Have you here.
Thank you.
Oh, it's wonderful.
And don't forget the Dodgers.
Yeah.
Los
Dodgers.
Dodgers lost last night.
Yeah, si, pero we was robbed, man.
Oh, that's Brooklyn, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a legacy there.
Well, they're still paying for you-know-what.
Where is Walter O'Malley?
For those of us of a certain age.
Yes.
And Teresa Bourgeois is with us as well. Good morning. All right. So we are here. Let us get to what is happening in the world. And we were just talking about this during the break, but I'm fascinated by this story, and I don't really know why. But the JFK files, the granddaddy of all conspiracy theories, has reemerged in the American psyche with the planned release of the National Archives' final trove of records about the assassination of President JFK. Kennedy's death on November 22, 1963, and the numerous investigations that followed were simultaneously some of the most secretive and public events in modern history. The last of the sealed document, the sealed government papers relating to the assassination are expected to be made public by Thursday after President Trump announced last week he would not block their release. Government agencies, Hollywood big shots, and amateur sleuths have floated theories of what happened to Kennedy, and it's been going on for over 50 years, as we well know. So what will we find out from the papers, if anything? It is a story that has been investigated again and again. What is in these papers? What will we find out? Will it ever be a closed case? Probably not. And by the way, and this is sort of where I come in from this, and I just I'll just throw it out there, which is why can't you wait until longer when Carolyn isn't around, the family isn't, you know what I mean? It just seems, I don't know.
You know, I'm fascinated, as you are, by this. I've always been thinking about Jack Ruby. You know, that's so fascinating. How do you, as you're hauling Oswald out of there, how do you allow a thug like that with a gun, think about this, to be standing there and do it? And then how convenient that he dies in a cell, in a prison cell somewhere, of cancer, which maybe he had before, I suspect he did. And that is, to me, one of the missing things in all of this. I think Oliver Stone picked this to do a movie on because he knew that there were a lot of people who had questions.
So you see two conspiracies.
I see lots of conspiracies.
But you think Oliver Stone picked it as a movie because he knew there was money to be made?
Yeah, but there was money to be made. You're right. But there was money to be made because there was a lack of definition or credibility in a lot of people's minds about what had happened.
I just hope this puts it the rest one way or the other. Was there a conspiracy? Was there not a conspiracy? Was Oswald just a jerk? Was there someone who was protected, and that's the reason these papers are all secretive all these years?
Yeah,
is there a national security question? I mean, can we just get the answers out there finally?
No.
And then, well, Trump said he may not release them all. So I wonder if the release of this, and even if you hold back two documents, is that going to create additional conspiracy theories?
Well, Trump won't release the document that shows that Marco Rubio's, or was it Ted Cruz's father?
It's Ted Cruz's
father was involved in the assassination.
Yeah, he denigrated his wife
But I'm fascinated. Okay, out come these documents, thousands of pages of documents.
Yes.
And so what happens next? Stu, you're the editor. The stuff comes
out. Hello, editor Stu.
Hi there.
You just see 50 reporters in a newsroom at the New York Times running through all of this stuff saying, and somebody yells out, "I got it."
Ooh.
Well, I think what they're going to do, and this is certainly not my area of expertise, but I think they're going to do some like electronic analysis of these records, because I assume a lot of this stuff is just not going to be, you know, papers of the Library of Congress. I assume some of this is going to be digitally available, and that there'll be scan programs and things like that where they're looking for certain words or certain word sequences and things like that. And you know, I don't think that tomorrow morning we're going to wake up and there's going to be 35 revelations that settle this whole thing. I just don't think it's going to be that quick. I think it's going to dribble out over a few days, a few weeks. I think there's going to be some things that are going to be added up. I certainly think we're going to hear from the Kennedy family.
I'd be surprised if we didn't.
And
I think they're releasing them digitally, right? They're electronically.
What I saw was that at least a good portion of them, if not all, will be digital.
But Congressman Joe Kennedy III said that, you know, certainly it's his decision, but if only he had... They did not contact the family
right.
in advance. I mean, that would have been the decent thing to do. But
right. Oh, decency.
This is the Trump.
That is so 20th century. We're done with that.
but you wonder. It seems in my reading, Stu, of this is that most people think that this will just. And I guess you alluded to this, but that most people. Think that this will just create more conspiracy theories than it will solve.
And even if they say they released it all, how do we know?
Yeah.
That might be a conspiracy.
We'll never know.
And there will be people explaining why they didn't release it all, whether it's true or not. Most of us are going to probably wait for Rachel Maddow to explain it to us. And one thing I've learned watching this, it's you know, release it on a Thursday. The only thing better for the White House is to have released it on Friday
or Sunday,
thus kicking off this, you know, this gigantic fog bank for a few days.
in the midst of the House passing
exactly
the bill. Opioid crisis
exactly.
this afternoon, JFK files this afternoon, in the midst of the House approving this budget that will redefine us as a country for years.
Yes, indeed.
And if you do that Thursday and Friday, you can see through the fog to Bedminster by Saturday.
All goes to a question: when Mueller is about to come out with his report, what are they going to find?
The Lincoln assassination papers will come out on that day.
Yes, right. Yes, I'm telling you, Area 51. You'll find out.
Oh, that's right. The UFO.
You'll find out about the aliens right before Mueller speaks.
And as part of that pattern, Trump just tweeted: "Ed Gillespie will turn the really bad Virginia economy around and fast, strong on crime, and he might even save our great statues heritage."
Oh.
So add in a little race baiting to go with the opioid crisis and the JFK files to cover up, you know, this House vote this afternoon on the budget and the tax framework.
I would hope Mr. Gillespie will be strong against crime and not strong on crime.
Well, he's strong on crime, according to Donald Trump.
A pro-crime.
That's the editor in me, sorry.
We appreciate that.
Yeah,
we appreciate
that.
Don't dangle those participles if you don't have to.
All right, we got a couple letters.
Okay, here we go from Leah. Dear panel, I'm a college professor currently enrolled in a class to become certified alcohol and substance abuse counselor. What I have learned in regards to addiction is that once the addiction has happened and the addiction with opiates is fast, most addicts are then in a maintenance, in quotes, position. The withdrawal is so awful and difficult that they would rather stay the course and attempt to function with the addiction. Substance use is absolutely a disease that requires treatment. This has to be understood for the country to move forward in a fight against it. And Leah, thank you for doing what you're doing, and thank you for taking this up as a profession. I think that's great.
Yeah, good information. Thank you for writing.
Yeah. And Patrick says, the panel is overlooking the connection between America's longest ever war in Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria and the impact on our veterans, opioids for pain management.
Well, drug addiction among veterans is a serious issue that people don't focus enough time on. And
good
I had
letter.
A friend who, he was a prison priest and talked often about how tragic it was that so many veterans ended up in prison when they really needed to get counseling and
assistance.
They
needed assistance. The VA.
They needed the VA, and they ended up in prison, and it was tragic.
Yeah. Well, you know, to drag it back a little bit to the immigration issue, one of the stories that I've worked on and off for a long time is the deported warriors. You know, there's a huge population of undocumented folks who went to war for us, believing that that would give them legality, you know, acceptance and documentation, and they were wrong. And those folks were deported, almost all of them, for a drug violation, which was a low-level felony. They can never return to the United States until they die, because they were discharged not with dishonor, but, you know, honorable discharge. Their bodies can then be returned to the United States and buried with full regalia. It's insane.
Bit of a contradiction.
It is, isn't it? And those gents dress in full uniform and stand at the border saluting people returned to the United States. That's their silent protest every day. But this is the same issue, and they will tell you, we needed help. We didn't need hardcore. We came back, you know, as we spoke before the earlier break about the inner psychic pain.
And there wasn't there, Luis, wasn't there a an understanding, at least, that if you served, you would get citizenship?
Oh, yes. Some of the recruiters actually told them that.
Yeah.
You'll get citizenship. And surprise, surprise, surprise.
They pulled out the rug.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So Anne says, for your information, tomorrow is Drug Take Back Day.
Right.
There are many places in the capital region where people can return unused medication, including narcotic meds. Contact your local pharmacy for more information. And that's from Ann.
Pharmacy is the place to start.
Okay. And also, state police headquarters, you can always drop off. They always have drop-offs there now anytime. But they do twice a year, the Drug Take Back Day, to get these drugs out of people's houses. And
you get a receipt?
No, you don't.
I knew you were going to add something.
Actually, I know somebody who was really concerned about that, who was prescribed OxyContin and didn't want to take it, but wanted to have proof that the person didn't take it and couldn't get a receipt. They wanted it out of their house, but they wanted to have some evidence that they didn't, because they thought that they were given too many.
Well, actually, I didn't say it before because I'm not stupid, but I'm going to say it again. But this time I'm going to say it. If you drop the stuff off at the police station and there is no chain of responsibility for who took it from you, that leaves a lot of very expensive drugs out there on the market. Now do you see what I mean? Okay, so what?
Yes, everybody's nodding silently.
Yes, yes, we're nodding.
You're making a face, Teresa. Okay.
Well, I want to think better of people, but...
Oh, really? Okay.
In some cases.
Lisa says about opioids, you can safely drop your old prescription drugs off at the pharmacy at any hospital. It is also better to do this than throw it down the drain. And that's true.
Do not flush.
It pollutes our water.
Yes, water sources.
Well, Lisa, you can certainly, I think you have a good point. You can certainly call the pharmacy at your hospital. But I'm not sure all pharmacies at hospitals take this stuff.
And certain ones they can take back. But they do have these take-back days, and the state police do, at least in New York State, the state police do take them back.
You can also call your county health department. I'm sure they would offer resources.
All right.
Get them out of your house, that's for sure.
Let's go to, we only have a moment or two. So I just want to get back as one of the stories that I sent out last night, and you mentioned it earlier, Luis, and this is these border wall prototypes that were unveiled. And I don't know, it looks like a showroom. It just looks silly. Yeah. I don't know. It's the strangest thing.
It's absurd. The various iterations of the wall, pre-Trump, and now this new showcase, is so absurd. It's one of the greatest boondoggles in history. And if you watched the history of the wall, I'll give you two examples of it. An earlier version of the revamped wall was cutting off parts of Texas and giving them to Mexico. Part of a golf course was on the wrong side of the new beefed-up steroidal fence that was put up. And I'm just telling you now that the ghost of General Santa Anna is dancing with glee, that he's stealing Mexican land back from the United States with no effort whatsoever. And the other thing that I just, being originally from Tijuana and San Diego, you know, the new fence, the new mega fence pre-Trump, was put up by undocumented Mexican workers. And, you know, the head of that company was imprisoned for it. So there's a little joke among the immigrants that, you know, let them put up the wall because they're going to hire us to build it. And then when it's up, we're going to put up all the taco stands, and we're going to sell all the tchotchkes. And when it's time to take it down, they'll hire us to take it back down again. So, hey, it's work. It's impossible.
But isn't it unbelievable to all of you that in the beginning it looked like a no-brainer? It was the one thing he said he was going to do. He was, of course, going to get the Mexicans to pay for it.
Yeah, right.
But they weren't going to do that. It was just stupid. Not only Democrats, but Republicans don't like it. It's too expensive, and they don't want it.
So $21 billion.
Yeah, and it's physically impossible. Much of that border is vertical, and there's just no way. And the catastrophe on an environmental level is insane. And what are you going to do along the Rio Grande? What side of the Rio Grande are you going to have the giant wall on to cut off one of the great American rivers? Our side or their side? Or will the wall go right down the middle of the river? It's just physically impossible what they're promising. And yeah, the cost is insane. And, you know, their sections, the high-tech sections with the observation towers and so forth, are Israeli in design. You know, Israel, I think the Gaza example is not necessarily a sterling example for 2,000 plus miles of our border. And then one asks, well, the easier border is the Canadian border. There's a heck of a lot of wall up there. People could just stroll across for about 3,000 miles in a lot of places. So I spend time because of some of my books with Border Patrol guys, and there are Border Patrol agents up there on the northern border. And I ask them, "What do you do?" And they say, "Well, we sort of walk up and down the river. There's nothing to do."
We are out of time, so we're going to end there. But I do want to. Well, you'll have an opportunity. Go to Union College tonight at 7 o'clock.
Yeah, let's chat.
You'll be there. Luis Alberto Urrea will speak tonight at 7 o'clock in the Knott Memorial. His talk, Universal Border, from Tijuana to the World. He is a member of the Latino Literature Hall of Fame. His most recent book is The Water Museum, a collection of short stories, which was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner. It is has been an honor to have you on our program. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, wonderful.
Thank you very much for being with us. Stu, you too.
Well, I have written some very pithy grocery lists, for the record.
We'll see you soon.
Thank you very much.
Teresa, thank you very much. Alan, of course, we'll be back with more Roundtable after this.